You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Okay. Right. Right, that's all running. That's all good. So let's make you a bit bigger so I can see. Cool. And would you like me to introduce you as this Rick Rule from Rule Investment Media?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Any way you wish.
Anyway, okay. All right. No, that's fine. Okay, I want to be a bit further over that way. There we go. Okay. Okay, good. Well, welcome back to the Market Musings podcast here from Stockbox, where Rick Rule from Rule Investment Media is joining us for the second time. Thank you so much for your time, Rick. How are you? How have things been?
Life has been great, thank you. And I trust for you.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, this year's been interesting, certainly on the minings and junior mining front for the stock market. I mean, I was at Resourcing Tomorrow last week. I know you were at Northern Miner just at the start of that week as well. I mean, the vibe I've been getting is, yes, it's been a tough year. And I remember I did a summary of the event last year where I sort of said, there's money there for compelling projects, but it's holding back at the moment. I was summing up this year's one and I was saying the same thing, but then I thought, actually, I do get the feeling the money is a bit looser than perhaps it was a year ago. And I got the vibe things were a bit busier and people were looking at green shoots. But it's been, I would say, actually quite a difficult year for the market, certainly in the UK, anyway, from our point of view. Seems like companies are struggling to get raises away. Brokers are struggling. There seems to be a lack of capital flowing around. But what's your take from the other side of the pond?
Mine's different. And I think the market that I've experienced has been for 2.5 years different than the market that you describe. The brokers are having a difficult time raising money because the brokers have done a poor job for their clients for about 20 years. And I think the chickens are coming home to roost. The brokers who listen to this won't like it, but that's okay. But I found, at least for my own needs, that for the last 30 months, there's been plenty of capital available for good deals. I've participated in something over 20 financings in the last 2 years, and almost all of them were oversubscribed. I keep hearing that there's no capital available, and I keep getting cut back in my allocations. What I think is beginning to happen is that for the first time in 40 years, capital markets for junior mining are becoming rational, which is to say that the high-quality people and the high-quality assets are getting easily financed, and the flotsam and jetsam and the dross are getting what they deserve, which is to say nothing. Okay. My hope is that that continues. Certainly, my own portfolio in terms of the aftermarket performance picked up noticeably this year. We've seen projects that were limping that maybe as a consequence of the increase of the gold price or maybe simply the maturity of the project. I think we'll talk about Alphamin later, where the progress of the company has begun to be reflected both in the dividend stream and in the share market prices. Suffice it to say, my sub $5 billion market cap portfolio has had a very good year.
Okay, that's interesting to hear. You're almost saying that the brokers have done a bad job, so people are less confident to give them their money effectively.
That's certainly true. I have attempted to participate in probably 30 transactions in the last 2 years. I have been shown probably 300 transactions.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to say every broker, but many brokers seem to have difficulty differentiating in movie parlance between the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah. So they're selling people, yeah, everything they can yeah. basically sell them.
Yeah. Okay. And mercifully, a lot of folks are fed up with that. You know, there's a lot of absolute crap that would have been funded 20 years ago that doesn't get funded now. And I think that's very useful. I think it's useful for the industry. There is a lot of capital. If the allocation was restricted to high quality people and high quality projects, and that may be beginning to come true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it might be like you say, sort of the wheat from the chaff is being sorted, because I know in London for sure, a lot of companies have delisted. AIM, of course, the market that everyone loves to hate over here in London, has seen an exodus of companies. You know, it's yep. more than halved, I think. So companies are leaving because they believe they can get better access to private capital on better terms, effectively. They feel that the listing fees are very expensive. They feel that they're just, the markets aren't functioning. You know, they're just being, their share prices are being destroyed, and they're having difficulty then raising capital because, yeah, the share price is just dropping and it results in massive dilution. But as you say, maybe they're just not great companies. I don't know. But they seem to think they can get better chances off market.
I think AIM probably needs to reform itself a bit in that it has become, like the old Vancouver Stock Exchange was, a bit of a dealer's club.
Yeah.
And I think probably if AIM became more investor-centric and if it became friendlier to foreign investors, that liquidity would return to AIM. I love London capital markets in the sense that there are very high-quality investors in London, both institutional and family office, who I get along with very well. That's the reason that I went to speak in London, aside from the fact that my wife loves London at Christmas.
Another, who doesn't?
Another important reason. But I think that the AIM market itself, it needs to reflect on its customer service, and it needs to reflect on how it treats non-DOM investors. The mm-hmm. TSX went through a bit of reformation 10 years ago in terms of some of the dealer practices that were unfriendly to investors. And I think the ASX is in the process of going through that same exercise today. And I think that the AIM market needs to do that too. There's a wonderful place for the AIM market. The London investment community is really non-ethnocentric, which is wonderful. And there's a tradition of expertise around mine finance in London that goes back a very long time. If that were reflected institutionally in the exchange, AIM is a project that could be salvaged fairly easily.
Well, I'm hoping that some changes are indeed on the horizon. I was talking to someone from the London Stock Exchange at the Resulting Tomorrow show last week, and he was actually on a panel. And one of the key discussion points was how can we reinvigorate London and also reinvigorate it as a center for African mining finance. So it seems to be very much on the cards. And he did talk about, we've got to lower the barriers to entry. We've got to make things easier for the retail investors with all the technology that's available now, you know, and of course, a lot of retail investors are going after what you might call fast money in crypto, you know, and that's always quite yeah. a good, I think, risk on kind of indicator with what's going on. So I do sort of get mixed signals in the market. I sort of see the big indices all kind of at all-time highs, but then I see talk of fear and huge collapses coming. But it's typically when everyone's talking about a collapse that it's probably not going to happen. It usually comes as when everyone is not really expecting it. But what sort of vibe did you pick up from your London trip at Northern Miner?
Well, you know, certainly at a small mining-centric conference like the Northern Miner Conference, the question you ask is sort of like going to the choir in an evangelical church and saying, do you believe in God? you know, understand that the Northern Miner Conference probably had 100 people at it. Probably half right. of those were from the issuer community. So that community is probably perpetually bullish. I think an easier way to mention, at least an easier way for me to measure sentiment, is through my own Rural Investment Media database. That database is growing very rapidly, and it is much more international than it used to. my database, mm-hmm. Mark, used to look like me, old, bald, white, fat, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's changed. The new people, the new subscribers to Rule Investment Media are predominantly under 50, mostly under 40, 30% female. Importantly, increasingly non-Caucasian, which is to say the market is global, the market is young, and the mining industry is so hidebound, so stuck in its ways, that rather than addressing the market that exists, they keep going back to the market that's dying because that's what they're used to doing. I think the market is much, much, much healthier than the conference circuit would indicate.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I was talking to a lady, Marley Palin, from BHP Explore, and she was really dynamic, actually. And she was telling me that she'd come from the tech industry, sort of bringing that Silicon Valley tech startup idea to mining. And she actually said, we've got to make mining sexy again, you know, seed capital, access to networks and skills, and really accelerate some of these junior miners. And I actually thought, out of everyone who, and the Resourcing Tomorrow conference is huge, bear in mind, out of everyone that was there, which must have been thousands of people, there was maybe only 2, 3, 4, 5 sort of people who I would say were sort of different, who kind of made you think, oh, okay, cool. You know, actually, this is something worth investing in. But I mean, where do you think we are in terms of a general sort of risk on, risk off appetite at the moment, but also with the miners? Do you think they're still pretty significantly undervalued?
If you segregate, I don't think that the mining market as a whole is undervalued because I think that 85% of the juniors in the world have no value whatsoever, which means if they have a bid, they're overvalued. If you look at 15% of that market or 10% of that market, in other words, if you look at 300 or 350 listed juniors that are real, that market is undervalued. The investor has not yet learned in movie parlance how to segregate between the good, the bad, and the ugly. They tend to lump the whole sub-billion market cap space or sub-2 billion market cap space into one bucket. And that's an enormous mistake.
So it's distinguishing from the good, the bad, the ugly. And you can help with that, can't you, I think, with your...
Absolutely. But your listeners, I mean, yes, I can help. And yes, I'd love to help. And no, I don't charge for it. But the truth is that the listeners, with the application of a bit of common sense, can do it for themselves. It's just that people don't, most people, I think, would prefer to feel as opposed to think, which is unfortunate.
True.
You know, further on the juniors, we'll make people sick before we make them well, Mark. I think if you looked at the junior sector in toto, you merged every listed junior on the globe into one company called Junior Explore Co. List it where you like. That company in a very good year would lose $2 billion. Mm-hmm. In a bad year, it would lose 10. So how should you value them? Should you value them at 8 times losses or 12 times losses? What's the correct price loss ratio? That cynical viewpoint disguises the fact that probably 10, maybe 15% of the listings generate so much utility that they add luster and legitimacy to an industry that loses at best $2 billion a year. So when you ask about valuations, you really have to subdivide between the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good are historically undervalued right now, in my own opinion.
Okay.
Well, and the bad and the ugly, by the way, are still
demonstrably
overvalued because they're overvalued. Worth nothing.
Okay. No, as I say, I think you've got to, you have to look at them properly, and we can, obviously, people can submit their portfolios to you to review, can't they? But I think you've got to do things a little bit differently as well, address a different audience to attract that capital back. And also educating people as well, that, you know, mining, if you can't grow it, we need to mine it. Uranium was a big talk of the show last year. Of course, that price did extremely well a year ago and has pretty much stayed standard. And I see a lot more talk now about uranium and uranium projects, government bodies, for example, really coming together to move on the uranium price. Just before we talk about some of the key commodities, just generally going into 2025, new government, where do you feel the kind of risk appetite is at the moment, how that might change, and what 2025 sort of looks like from your point of view. I know we've had, sometimes it feels like there's some tensions in the air, you know, people feeling the pinch a little bit. We've seen a few CEO of a listed company, healthcare, was obviously murdered just this week, I think, or a few days ago. You know, so where do you think you are, where we are in a global kind of, yeah, risk on, risk off appetite and just general kind of feelings in the world?
Well, if you're talking about our new government, I guess the outlook for resources is mixed. Certainly, the U.S. permitting regime is going to change, and it's going to change for the better. Some of the roadblocks to responsible mine development and responsible energy development are silly. And my suspicion is that our new president will keep that promise. I don't think there's many promises he made, by the way, that he will keep, but I think that's one. And I think that the attitude of the administration towards resource development will change. When I look, as an example, at my own efforts as a uranium investor over 40 years, 5 years ago, the administration's view for me was that I was a villain, that I was responsible for Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima. And now the morons want to subsidize me. That's an interesting shift. I have to say, I felt more clean when they hated me. okay. But, you know, there is something to feeling like you're not a target anymore. Mm-hmm. There are other aspirations that our president has, nationalistic aspirations, geopolitical aspirations, that I think will make international investing and, frankly, the global economy more challenging. The idea that he's selling to Americans that they should be nationalistic takes me back to the Smoot-Hawley Act, which ushered in the Great Depression. The free transmission of goods, services, and ideas makes humankind richer. What our president proposes doesn't. And by the way, I'm not partisan. I also think it's important for American taxpayers and consumers to understand that tariffs are taxes. The idea that foreigners pay for tariffs when Americans consume the goods is laughably stupid and widely believed. I think that there is an interesting and healthy anti-establishment bias that Trump managed to tap into. I think that's ironic because I think he's part of the establishment, but that's okay. And I think that that anti-establishment bias was partially reflective of, as you point out, the recent assassination of a CEO. I think there's a feeling, probably globally, but certainly in the United States, that the political establishment and the corporate establishment doesn't serve the interests of any constituency other than themselves. My preference would be that voters and taxpayers understand that most of the problem rests with the Commonwealth, and that part of the problem is corporate, probably manifests itself with corporate control of the government. I don't think that there is a broad realization of that in the United States yet. And I think that's very, very unfortunate. When people vilify the private healthcare system in the United States, I would prefer that they focused on regulatory capture, which is to say the extent to which the government enables the healthcare industry to be exploitive. I would also point out that in terms of the alternatives that are popular in the United States right now, which is to say so-called nationalized healthcare, that it's difficult to find a place where it worked. Not difficult to find a place where it's popular, but difficult to find a place where it's worked. And it's also interesting in the United States that when you look at the part of the healthcare system, the social safety net that is in the public sphere, which is to say government or organized, that it is really truly insolvent. Americans don't realize that because it's liquid. But the net present value of entitlement programs in the United States, the net present value of the unfunded liabilities, not the nominal value over time, but the net present value, exceeds, according to the Congressional Budget Office, $100 trillion today.
Hmm.
That's
I saw you. Yeah, it's huge. And I see you do tweets quite a lot on this. I picked them up. And I think you said if you took all the richest people and the 1%'s money, you wouldn't even touch it or something like that. It was something along those lines, wasn't it?
Not close. Not close. Yeah. This the Honorable Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Suggests that the cure for the nation's ailments is to increase the tax rate on the billionaires.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Mr. Sanders, while he's good at narrative, is not good at arithmetic. The aggregate net worth of America's billionaires, according to the IRS, is $5.6 trillion. The net present value of unfunded liabilities is $100 trillion. The on-balance sheet liabilities is $36 trillion. The negative accretion between on-balance sheet and off-balance sheet liabilities every year in the U.S. is $4.5 trillion. If you stole the entire net worth of every billionaire in the United States, didn't tax them, stole them, we wouldn't fund the government, but we would fund the deficit for a year and a half. I mean, this is pathetic arithmetic.
Yeah.
This guy, never mind, doesn't know how to multiply and divide. He doesn't know how to add and subtract.
So what happened before? I do want to move on and talk about stocks, but I do like this conversation. I mean, what happens then? You've talked about the corporate and the government not serving the interests of the people. Yes, 100%. I think we're feeling that quite a lot now. But then on the debt front, so I mean, what happens in your opinion, Rick?
I'm not an economist. I'm a credit analyst. But from a credit analyst's point of view, we're between a rock and a hard place.
Hmm.
What I think happens is what happened in the decade of the 1970s. We had a circumstance in the 1970s where cutting benefits was unpalatable and raising taxes was unpalatable. And so what we did was we reduced the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar through inflation.
Okay.
In the period 1970 to 1980, the U.S. government says that the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar declined by 75%. So we honored the nominal value of our obligations by inflating away the net present value of those obligations. Yeah, and that's precisely what happens this time, I think.
Yeah, I would tend to agree, inflate it away. So, okay, well, that does bring us nicely onto, okay, if that's going to happen, if your purchasing power is going to drop, let's say even just again by 75%, where do you put your purchasing power? Where do you put your money? I mean, the obvious place is gold, isn't it? First of all, I would say.
It's difficult for me to understand why a numerate investor wouldn't own some physical gold for insurance purposes. You don't have to own a lot, because when the circumstance, when the public ethos around gold changes, the gold price accelerates so much that in insurance parlance, a fairly small premium, which is to say a fairly small gold holding, shelters a lot of your portfolio, an awful lot of your portfolio. The idea that people are uninsured, that they don't have any holdings of physical gold at all, to me seems fiscally irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
I think for people who are willing to do some work and take some risk, that investing in gold stocks, which is different than owning gold, investing mm-hmm. in an asset class, is a way to capitalize on that trend. I don't think that you need to own a lot of them, but I think a focus on the highest quality names from an investment point of view makes sense. For your listeners, people who are willing to go above and beyond, they're willing to do some work. They're willing to look at balance sheets, willing to look at income statements, willing to get away from narrative and dig in the weeds of mining companies. The speculative mining companies offer real alpha, but they only offer real alpha to people who can stomach volatility and are willing to do some work to differentiate between the good, the bad, and the ugly. Most of the investors, unfortunately, in juniors for the last 40 years, have operated under the investment ethos, quote, got a hunch, bet a bunch. And that hasn't worked for them well in the last 40 years, nor will it work for them well in the next 10.
Okay. Can you name any of gold miners that you sort of hold or you like the look of?
Well, in the beginning of the exercise, the ones that I'd like your listeners to pay attention to,
sure.
Not the ones that they
yeah,
might.
Yeah.
I'd start with the best. I'd start with Franco Nevada, Wheaton Precious, Agnico Eagle. If you can stomach West African political risk, I think Endeavor is almost felony cheap. And I don't think you need to go below that. If you okay. want to, I think Newmont's recent work selling off their Tier 2 assets probably yields a very different Newmont 18 months from now than now.
Okay.
But the jury's still out. They've missed guidance for six quarters in a row. I also think that Barrick is very much a work in progress, but I don't think that you need to take the risk inherent in either Newmont or Barrick to capture market beta. And I think market beta is going to be great. Frankly, I would rather underperform the broad market by 10 or 15% while sure. de-risking it operationally by owning the best of the best.
Speak to Mark Bristow actually at the show, and he did say, he said copper's going to be a big focus, but of course yep. precious metals as well. Just on the sort of smaller end, Greatland Gold?
I am very long Greatland Gold.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I think it's important that people that come down into that end don't pay attention primarily to the names in this interview, but rather that they pay attention to the companies and that they focus on the interplay between the balance sheet and the income statement on a quarter-by-quarter basis. I think that Greatland surprises people to the upside because I'm a fan of their geology and I'm a fan of most of the ways that they're bringing this to account. But I think that an understanding of the dynamics of that is probably required for most people to speculate in Greatland Gold. What I don't want is for somebody to hear the interview, then remember 12 months from now, Rick liked Greatland Gold, and to assume that nothing had changed within a year that would make Greatland either better or worse as a speculation or investment.
No, absolutely. I can tell you that I bought Greatland Gold 2000 and I think 15, 16, something like that.
Yep.
0.007 or something, no, 0.03 or something really low.
Yep.
And I sold it just below 0.8 or whatever it was, 0.08. So I nearly doubled my money, my first one bagger. And I needed the cash for something, my wife's university fees I needed
yep.
to pay. So I sold out, really pleased with myself, doubling my money. If I'd held on to all of those shares today, that'd be worth a lot more. But you're right, a heck of a lot can change in
but
even
you know,
just a few months.
Making some money is not the worst outcome.
Not at all.
Losing money is a bad outcome. You can bemoan that which you didn't get. But the truth
yes.
is that you made one really good decision, and then you made a necessary decision, and you had a happy outcome. So don't beat yourself
yes.
up for making money.
No. It went to a good course. Just quickly on Gold, I don't know if you know these companies. This came to mind because they were at the show last week. So you've got Minera, Alamos, and U.S. Gold Corp. Are you familiar with either of those two?
Yeah, I don't own either of those. I'm not particularly attracted myself to smaller mid-sized mines.
Sure.
What I've learned, sadly, in my life, Mark, is that everything that can go wrong with a big mine can go wrong with a small mine. But a small mine can only ever make you small money.
Yeah, okay.
I don't like taking big risks for small rewards.
Okay, no, that's absolutely fine. Tin, then. Tin was the talk of
yep.
the show as well. And I know you mentioned Alphamin there. You know you hold Alphamin. The reason I have an interest in tin is because we work with Rome Resources here in London here.
Yep.
And I think the guys who run Rome Resources sort of were involved in establishing the Alphamin and then sold it on. And now they're sort of back, if you like, to go again, if you like, for round two. Now, I appreciate you might not know a whole lot about Rome Resources, but generally, let's just talk about the Alphamin area, the DRC, and why you like that kind of geology in that project.
That is, and I think the geology does extend onto the Rome ground. That's the best tin geology, perhaps, in the history of humankind. It compares favorably with Patino. Going back to the 1700s, unbelievably rich, also resistive, so that it sticks out of the ground. It's not so hard to find. The area that it's in is a mess. Northeastern Congo has everything going wrong that it possibly could. AIDS, Ebola, warlords, malaria. It's absolutely a mess. The ability of the Alpha Men people to, first of all, build a mine there, 60K back in jungles, and then to transport concentrates from the mine through 800 miles of warlords, where the average truckload of concentrates is worth $500,000 people, where you can hire a contract killer for $100, is amazing. There are real political risks. I've been there. Real social risks. It's a horrific part of the world. It's the worst part of a bad country. But it's an almost fictionally attractive geological environment.
Okay. But Rome is probably a bit too small for you at your, no, your stage in life.
I owe myself to look at Rome. The exploration upside on the Alpha Men side of the border is very attractive, and it's supported by dividends. The truth is, at 71 years of age, I've simply been too lazy to look at Rome, and that's no excuse. I should do that. It's traditionally, exploration speculation is something that I've been very good at, and I seem to be overlooking a potential 10-bagger in favor of a certain double or triple, which is stupid.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you my list and then I'll make sure that's on there. And then next time we speak, we can go over it. Graphite and, of course, Sovereign Metals as well over in Malawi. That I know you're a big holder of that. And they're really developing, aren't they, quite nicely now with everything that's going on.
I'm a big Sovereign holder. There's a lot that can go wrong. The recent trial mining and bench test processing have been really, really attractive, better than I had anticipated. Sadly, at 71 years of age, I've learned that there's a big difference between a bench test and a mine. A problem with regards to scale. I am attracted to deposits that I believe will be low-cost participants in their industry. And in both rutile and graphite, it appears that Sovereign will be in the best cost quartile worldwide. It also appears that they'll be in the best quartile worldwide in terms of return on capital employed. I think, but don't know, that it's more likely than not that the ticker symbol changes to RTP from Alpha Men, which I think is unfortunate. I would prefer to be part of funding that company's growth to the extent that they could become tier one producers of both graphite and rutile. I don't think that'll happen. And the fact that I get paid some now is a wonderful consolation prize.
So you just continue to sit there quite happy and the outcome, is what it is.
My hope is that you'll see continued political disruption or challenges in Malawi. And my hope, too, is that the investor base will continue to be bored of commodities like rutile and graphite, that they can't spell, and that the price will go down so that I can buy more.
If
you want to own more of something, perversely, you prefer soft markets. And in the case of Sovereign, my greed is such that I would love to see it fall 20 or 25% in price.
Okay, good. Well, good to know. And then you're ready with the buy button there. Okay, good to know. Before we talk about just some of the commodities and uranium, of course, I know before we started talking, you're a minor investor. We talked about that, but you also have some experience with banks. And we'll talk about your bank as well that you've just recently started, but also insurance companies. And I want to just talk briefly about an insurance company called Ondo InsurTech. It is a junior on the London market. It's about 40 million market cap at the moment. It's gone up quite a lot recently. And what Ondo have is a little device that goes on your water pipe in your home, and it detects if you've got a water leak, and it's very accurate. There's a similar device called Ting, which is already in the marketplace, that plugs into a wall socket and detects for electrical arcs to prevent fires. So anyway, Ondo have got their product. It's patented. It's been around for a few years. And they're really now accelerating their drive to get this product and their service into insurers around the world. They've got a big client in Sweden. They've got some in the UK, big names. And they're also really starting to make waves with some big insurance names in the United States, scaled up their plant in the UK, the factory in the UK, so they can produce 10,000 of these. And effectively, yeah, it's per head. So the insurance company pay, I think it's $5 per seat, if you like. And they send out this little device to people's homes. They pop it on their water inlet, and it tells them if they've got a water leak, so it could be prevented. And then automatically through the app or however the insurance company want to do it, a plumber is then sent out to fix that. And the feedback from insurance companies is fantastic. And I just see Ondo InsureCheck just getting more and more big insurance names, particularly over in the United States, where, you know, obviously insurance is a huge part of Americans' lives, isn't it? It's a huge industry. So I know you don't know much about it, but I wanted to sort of drop the seed, if you like, and maybe you can have a look and we can talk about it next time. But on the surface of it, what do you think of the idea?
Well, I need to caveat my comment by saying that my track record in technology and process is almost unblemished by success. So I wouldn't want to burden your listeners with that. I was brought up in Silicon Valley, and I've been attracted to technology as opposed to successful in technology. Okay. I would be much more inclined myself to be a lender to the insurance company that utilized the product as opposed to a speculator in the product, because I understand insurance and I understand banking and I understand process less well than some of my competitors. I've had a longtime friend and colleague and customer, frankly, Paul Stevens of Roberts and Stevens, a big, big, big technology underwriter. And I remember him telling me 40 years ago that the half-life of application technology that he funded was 18 to 24 months, which meant that by the time I understood the business well, it was obsolete. And the consequence of that is that I'm attracted to old man's industries.
Okay.
Cyclical industries like gold and coal and oil and property and casualty insurance.
Sure. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Not begging off, but I'm begging off.
Yeah. Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. No, I understand completely what you're saying. I do like that company personally. I know them quite well. And I'll just let you know that I have a son who's 9 months and I opened a junior, what we call a stocks and shares ISA in the UK, a tax-free wrapper. And the first money that came in from the government for child benefit, I put into Ondo InsureTech. And he's not even 1 year old and he's up 180% on that stock. So he's doing better than me.
Wonderful. And hopefully when he's 8 years old, you'll show him the device so that it makes the connection between how he made the money and how the device adds utility to society.
Exactly.
I've advised some family offices for years, and one of the things I really liked was them starting their children's accounts with a telephone company and saying, every time you see somebody use a cell phone, they're making you money. Buying them McDonald's and saying every time you or somebody else eats a hamburger at McDonald's, the reason that the share price goes up is because people like their hamburgers. So I hope that you make the connection for your son between delivering utility for civilization and making money in your stock account.
I will. Your bank then, Rick, tell us about your bank that you are involved in.
Yeah, I'd ask all your listeners if they're happy with their current bank, if they're satisfied. My suspicion is that 95% will say no. And that's my target market. This is now my seventh bank. And this bank really goes back to a bank we started in 1998 called EverBank, one of the first internet-based banks in the United States, where rather than having physical branches, our branch was your computer or your phone. That lowered our non-interest expense by about 35% compared to our peers. We were able to use that savings by always being in the top quartile in interest payers on deposits nationwide. In other words, we passed the savings back onto the consumer. Most American banks, big banks, have 15 or 20 different savings products. We have one. 15 or 20 is designed to confuse the consumer, often into signing up for an account that pays him or her either no interest or subpar interest. Mm-hmm. With us, you have a high-yield money market account. Write a check if you want to. Put it on automatic bill pay if you want to. You get paid interest. And I think most people would prefer to be paid interest as opposed to the relationship that they currently have with their bank. In addition, our bank, like EverBank, will allow its depositors, its certificate of deposit depositors, to bank in many currencies. In Great Britain, you bank in pounds. In the United States, you bank in dollars. At our bank, you can bank in euros, you can bank in Canadian dollars, Australian dollars. The choice is yours. It's your money. That product is offered in the United States, but with a $1 million minimum. At our bank, it'll be offered with a $10,000 minimum. In other words, an institutional-grade savings program to the mass affluent.
Okay.
Another interesting thing, probably of interest to your audience at least, in the United States, none of our competitors' banks believe that gold is a good collateral. There's no bank that lends on gold in a segregated account. There's $33 billion worth of bullion in the United States that we've identified in segregated accounts, and nobody lends against it. So we will establish what is in effect a margin loan against gold, not, by the way, gold buried in your backyard, but rather gold at Brinks, Loomis, or Viamat, so that you can access the liquidity that you might need on a temporary basis without having to sell your gold.
Okay.
That's an important product for us because the community that we served at EverBank and the community that I served at Sprott for a very long time is a gold-centric community. We know those people because we are those people, which means that our customer acquisition cost is low and our ability to design both the product and lending products that service this community is, I think, first rate. There's a huge business in the United States around community banks. Most of these banks define community geographically. I define my community by shared interests, the aspiring, self-directed, mass affluent customer. It's the customer base I've served all my life. At EverBank, we built a 275,000-person customer base with the deposits when we sold it at $28 billion. Similarly, at Sprott, we built a 250,000-person constituency around exchange-traded products with now, 33, $34 billion in AUM. This is a market that we understand well. It's a market that we aspire to serve. It's a market that we have served. So any of your people who are unhappy with their current banking relationships, who would like small favors, like being able to invest in the currency of their choice or be paid interest on their savings, or have lending products tailored to their own needs, should check out BattleBank at battlebank.com.
And that's launched, ready to go right now in North America.
We are buying an existing federally chartered small bank and recapitalizing it. We have been in the U.S. regulatory morass for 2.5 years. Buying a small bank and recapitalizing it is inelegant. But the fact is that we've tried the front door channel for 2.5 years. We anticipate being open for anybody's business in March of 2025.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you, Rick. I know I wanted to talk about uranium, but I know you've got a bit of a hard stop. So we'll probably have to leave uranium and a couple of those stocks for next time. But for now, thank you very much for your time, Rick Rule.
Thank you so much, Mark. I would urge any of your listeners who like what I have to say about natural resources and want to personalize it to come to my website, Rule Investment Media. Once there, list your natural resource stocks for no obligation, no charge. I will personally rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I'll comment on issues if I think my comments might have value. Please, no crypto. Please, no pot stocks, no psilocybin stocks, no tech stocks. Leave an old man to do what he does well. Rule Investment Media, list your natural resource stocks. I'll personally rank them. No charge, no obligation.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Okay, good stuff. Excellent.
Great.
Perfect. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, I didn't want to do uranium, but it's fine. I know you've got
pleasure. No, I'm happy to come on at you.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates. so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.